Why is it so hard to capture Ronald Reagan on the page? Jeff Schessel will join us to talk about H.W. Brands' new biography, Reagan, The Life.
He is a tough character to wrap your mind around. He represents a lot of contradictions beneath this very pleasant veneer that acknowledges no contradictions, that acknowledges no struggle.
Everyone knows about Jonas Salk's great achievement, but who was the man behind the polio vaccine? Charlotte DeCrows-Jacobs will tell us about her biography, Jonas Salk, A Life.
This kind of international idol whose smile shone from every newspaper and magazine when I was growing up didn't live happily ever after.
Alexander Alter will let us know what's going on in the publishing world. Greg Coles has bestseller news. And something new, we're letting our listeners weigh in. This week, readers have a few questions for us editors here at the Book Review. We'll offer some answers. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Jeff Schessel joins us now. His most recent book is Supreme Power, Franklin Roosevelt versus the Supreme Court. And this week in the Book Review, he reviews H.W. Brands' new biography of Ronald Reagan. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. So this biography, it's the first major biography of Reagan, you say, in more than a decade. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that Reagan is certainly, without question, a source of continuing fascination, and maybe even more when you look at the regard with which he's held by most conservatives, most Republicans. He is sort of a singular figure in the Republican pantheon. But I think even beyond the Republican Party, there is a recognition of Reagan as a truly historic figure, as one of the most significant presidents of the 20th century. And he's just outside the experience of many Americans, but there are others of us who came of age during that period, and he was a really titanic figure. So I think that there are always going to be new books on Reagan, and this is one of a growing bookshelf.
But it's been a while since we've had one of these big biographies of Reagan. Was the last one the Edmund Morris?
The last big biography of Reagan was the Edmund Morris book, which was a really curious book, as many people may remember. Morris had really incredible access to Reagan, spent a lot of time with Reagan when he was president. This was an authorized biography. Had very rare access to a lot of the papers and the letters that have subsequently become publicly available. And in the end, I think Morris, as he has indicated in interviews, found Reagan such a confounding figure, so mysterious, so enigmatic, and so private that he didn't know what to do with him. And so in order to bring out the elements of Reagan's personality and leadership that as he, Morris, saw them, he created a kind of semi-fictional account. It was actually quite a fictional account in which Morris himself was an old friend of Reagan's who had grown up with him. And I think that what Morris was trying to do was to illuminate deeper truths about Reagan that would be hard to access in a straight historical telling. But unfortunately, it was something of a debacle, and it may well have scared other big biographers off for a while.
When did that book Dutch come out?
That book came out, I believe, in the late 1990s.
It's interesting because both Morris and Brands wrote significant biographies of an earlier Republican icon, Theodore Roosevelt. Was there any similarities in sort of what they managed to tell or not tell about Reagan with the results?
Well, I think that Brands' account of Reagan is a much more kind of traditional approach. It's a straight biography. He doesn't try to go too deep. That, in fact, is one of the great, I think, missed opportunities of this book, is that in a way, while Morris seemed to drive himself a little crazy trying to plumb the depths, if there were any, of Reagan's personality, Brands has kind of taken a pass and seems perfectly content to sort of skate along the surface of Reagan's very sort of light and occasionally terse diary entries and public statements. And so they really have come at Reagan from two very, very different approaches. And the result, I guess, ironically, is the same in that both books leave you feeling at the end that Reagan may well be unknowable, that it may actually be a fool's errand to try to get any deeper, that Reagan was inaccessible in that way, even to those who were closest to him, even to his wife, Nancy.
Morris had, of course, incredible personal access, but hasn't there been a huge amount of declassified memos and documents that have come out subsequent to Morris's biography?
Absolutely. There have been many, many thousands, even possibly millions of pages that have been declassified by the federal government. Some of them are housed at the Reagan Library in California, others even at the CIA. There's an unbelievable trove of documentation. That really is one of the great missed opportunities of the Brand's book, is that he really hasn't reckoned with this at all. It is an enormous project, I think, for someone to go through these kind of archives. I think you'd have to do it in a very targeted way. You can't go through millions of pages comprehensively. But if you are going to write a massive biography of Ronald Reagan, and that is what this is, I think at this point in history, with all of that material publicly available, you really do have a responsibility as a biographer to reckon with it and see what it tells us about Reagan. Surely, in there, it tells us something that is new and many things that are significant.
And does Brands take advantage of this new information at all in the book?
No, he really seems, you know, if you look at his end notes, which of course I did, he really doesn't seem to have spent any time with these materials at all, which is perplexing. I can understand it as somebody who has done this sort of archival work himself, that this is an overwhelming undertaking, even more so when it comes to this relatively recent, an 8-year presidency. But again, I think at this point, there have been enough books written by Reagan that if you were going to write one that really matters at this point and really adds to the Reagan canon in some meaningful way, then you've got to get your hands dirty in these archives. And
Right. That
does not, at least based on Brands' end notes, that really doesn't seem to be something that he did here.
Now, if you're a presidential biographer, and that's what you do, and certainly Brands is one, and he's written about Jackson as well as Teddy Roosevelt and others, generally you have some kind of goal in your book, something that's going to distinguish it from the other presidential biographies of whoever the person is that are already out there. Does Brand state sort of what he sets out to do in this biography that's different from what, say, Lou Cannon did?
In terms of an overall approach to Reagan, a thesis about Reagan that is being essentially argued in the course of a biography, there is none of that that is apparent. And the thing that is, in the end, most striking about this book is that it is not striking at all. It's a very traditional telling of Reagan's life. And for anyone who has read a book on Reagan, this will all seem very familiar. There will certainly be some new details, but it lacks the richness of biographies in this weight class of biographies.
Weight class meaning really actual physical weight, because this is a big, heavy book, we should say.
A book that, you know, can this, break your toes.
Right. This is 805 pages. So this is right in time, you know, for Father's Day, for people who are looking for that kind of thing. You mentioned earlier that obviously Reagan was an enormously, or he enjoyed periods of enormous popularity, both during his presidency and subsequently. But he's also a polarizing figure. And one thing that might occur in a big biography like this is that there's some kind of political slant, whether it's legitimizing or exalting the figure or criticizing that person. Do you get a sense of where Brand stands? Is this even-handed? Does he have a point of view?
I think one of the things that Brands ought actually to be lauded for is that there is no partisan axe grinding here. He is not mythologizing Reagan either in the other direction. It is difficult to find a Reagan book that doesn't, as you suggest, that doesn't have a strong point of view that Reagan is angel or devil. And this book is free of that, and I think it should be applauded for that. I do think that it is a sympathetic account. He does seem to regard Reagan not only as a significant figure, but as a man who advanced both the national economy, the national self-conception, and our national security, and was ultimately a very successful president. But he doesn't shrink. Brands doesn't shrink from giving you the troubled side of the Reagan presidency, Iran-Contra, and the compromises that were made, or the contradictions or hypocrisies, in fact, of Reaganomics and the growth of the national deficit and the national debt and so forth. So it's a pretty straight account, a pretty balanced account in that regard, although ultimately pretty sympathetic.
You did mention a couple of times some interesting tidbits. Is there one in particular that you can recall that would be worth sharing?
Well, I think the most compelling section of the book for me was the account of Reagan's negotiations with Gorbachev. And there are transcripts of those conversations. And Brands is an excellent storyteller, and he does an excellent job of reconstructing the quiet but very intense and very long conversations that went on for hours and hours between Reagan and Gorbachev, in which they were really working hard not only to score certain points, but really to reach an agreement. And that is a very well-constructed section with a lot of richness of detail, and I think that's a very successful section. But I think that in the end, to the point that you made a moment ago, what is really lacking here is a sense of exactly why Reagan provoked, on the one side, such intense adoration, and on the other side, rage and in fact, hatred. You don't get a sense in this book of the context of the volatility in the country and why Reagan was loathed in much the same way that Obama is loathed mm-hmm. today, or Roosevelt was loathed in his own time. He seems to be quite a benign figure in this book. And so you can finish all 800 pages and be left wondering exactly why there was so much fuss.
It's interesting. Your review, many of the words you use to characterize the book are words that have been applied to Reagan himself, you know, sort of vaguely sympathetic, unknowable, vague, benign. Did you feel like the biography itself in a certain way embodied some of the critical view of Ronald Reagan?
I think that's exactly right. In fairness to Brands, and really in fairness to anybody who tries to reckon with Reagan on a grand scale, as this book does, he is a tough, tough character to wrap your mind around. He represents a lot of contradictions beneath this very pleasant veneer that acknowledges no contradictions, that acknowledges no struggle, that acknowledges no real questions. Reagan seemed, and this was very much how he projected himself and maybe even how he understood himself. One of the things that Brands makes very clear is that Reagan was both a pragmatist and, as Brands puts it, an ideologist. And so how can that be? And was he really more one than the other? How can those two things be reconciled? Reagan makes it very, very difficult. Morris tried, struggled, and failed in one very spectacular way. And I think this book, too, is a disappointment for very, very different reasons.
Well, you sound sympathetic, at least. Jeff Schessel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jeff is the author of Supreme Power, Franklin Roosevelt versus the Supreme Court. And this week, he reviews in the book review the new biography of Ronald Reagan by H.W. Brands. Alexandra Alter joins us now. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
So we're talking about a new story, but not a new story, right?
Exactly. So this year, it seems like the publishing industry is borrowing a page from Hollywood's playbook. Summer is always the season for reboots and sequels in Hollywood. And this year, in the book industry, we're seeing a lot of popular series being continued. Of course, there's Harper Lee's next book, which is a continuation of To Kill a Mockingbird. It takes place 20 years later. That was a huge surprise when it was announced. Other ones coming are the next installment of 50 Shades of Grey.
What color? I'm serious.
It's called Grey. Uh-huh. This was a huge surprise when the author E.L. James announced it on Twitter this week. Fans had been hounding her for a book from the perspective of the kinky billionaire Christian Grey. For our listeners who aren't among the millions of people that read the books, he is, of course, the one that introduces the demure college student Anna to the pleasures and pains of sadomasochistic sex.
What did the fateful tweet say for those who are not following E.L. James on Twitter?
It was basically saying, you asked for this, here it is.
Okay, then.
To paraphrase, she made it sound like she'd been hounded for years. Oh, and then finally, in a couple months, we're getting another installment of Stieg Larsson's incredibly popular series, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which is the Millennium series, which has sold more than 80 million copies worldwide. Of course, the author passed away before the original books even came out, but his estate has found another writer to continue the story, David Lagercrantz, who is a Swedish journalist and author. So there's three of the biggest publishing hits in the past few decades are getting continued. And of course, this is as close to a sure thing as you get in the publishing industry. These books are having massive first printing of millions of copies, and readers are going to flock to them. But they're always a little bit tricky. I mean, there's the risk of disappointing fans, of perhaps undermining someone's literary legacy. You never know when these books are going to live up to, you know, the originals or what people have come to love about the earlier book.
I want to see the Venn diagram where it shows who reads all three of those new installments.
Exactly.
Other than you, Alexandra.
No, it's an interesting question, though. I mean, the fans have already had sort of mixed reactions on several of these. There's a lot of enthusiasm, and particularly from the bookselling community, but there's also some skepticism.
We'll see if that is reflected on the bestseller lists. Thanks, Alexandra.
Thanks, Pamela.
Charlotte DeCroze Jacobs joins us now. She is the author of Jonas Salk, A Life, reviewed by David Oshinsky in this week's issue of The Book Review. Hi, Charlotte.
Good morning.
What made you decide to write a biography of Jonas Salk?
Well, Jonas Salk was really the great hero of my generation. Prior to his polio vaccine, as children, we were all afraid every summer that one of us would get polio. And on April 12, 1955, when it was announced that his vaccine could prevent polio, he became an international hero overnight. As the years went on, I didn't hear much about Jonas Salk for a few years after he was, of course, still in the news a lot. And I wondered what had happened to him, but there was no formal biography to inform me, so I set out to write one.
For those listeners who did not grow up before the vaccine in 1955, tell us a little bit about what it was like when polio was a significant threat.
Polio, the first major epidemic, was in 1916, and that was when about 27,000 were paralyzed and 6,000 died. And what made it very poignant is most of those were children. And after that first outbreak, there continued to be further outbreaks or epidemics of polio every single summer. So by 1952, about 57,000 were afflicted.
And that's in this country?
In this country.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost as if there were outbreaks of Ebola every summer and no way to stop it. And what made it terrible is that for those children who did survive, many were crippled, paralyzed for life. So we saw clips of children struggling with braces, entombed in iron lungs, and never knowing which community or which child would be struck. I remember being a child of that era, and no matter how good we were, if we behaved our mothers, if we went to church every Sunday, if we ate all our vegetables, we still could be the crippler's victim, and that is a terrible fear.
Of course, most people think of FDR when they think of polio, but describe what happens to a child who comes into contact with polio and why the summer?
Well, no one knows exactly why the summer. Lots of viruses have different seasonal variations, but the polio virus enters the body through the mouth, and then it multiplies in the gastrointestinal tract, and from there it can spread to the bloodstream and then on into the brain. So in many, it starts just with a kind of a sore throat, a runny nose. A few hours later, the child would spike a fever and become drenched in sweat and have electric shocks through the back and arms and legs. And then the fever would break, and the child would appear to be recovering. And within a day or two, paralysis would strike. And no one could predict whether it would be just a weak arm or 2 weak legs. Now, many, it would be aborted, that is, by the time after the fever, they somehow were able to overcome the polio virus themselves and did not go on to develop paralysis. And some had no symptoms whatsoever. If the polio virus attacks further up in the brain, the base of the brain, then the child would develop paralyzed throat muscles and couldn't swallow, and a sip of water would stream out his nose, and eventually a child would just quickly drown in his own secretions.
Let's fast forward to April 12, 1955. Can you describe what it was like on that day?
The day was at the University of Michigan. Thomas Francis Jr., who is a famed epidemiologist, was the person that the March of Dimes had selected to do all the epidemiology, all the statistics. So Salk did not know anything for an entire year about what was happening in terms of the trial. He did not run the trial himself. That was done through the March of Dimes. So on April 12th, which was kind of an overcast day, he met for breakfast with Thomas Francis and with Basil O'Connor, the director of the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis. And it was at that moment, 1 hour before the announcement was going to be made, that Jonas Salk learned that the vaccine had been a success. Not that he ever didn't believe it.
But why wasn't he involved until up until that point?
He had made the vaccine, and but he had done everything in his own laboratory with just a few people, and he tested almost every child himself, giving the shots himself. It was a smaller undertaking. Now we were talking about 1.5 million people being involved, or children involved, in a trial across the United States. So it had to be done by a larger organization. Also, Salk was falling out of favor with the scientific community, and in order for this to be the results of the trial to be actually believed and make a difference, Basil O'Connor decided, and Harry Weaver, who was the director of research, that it needed to be run by someone else, not Jonas Salk.
Here you have this moment where Salk is hailed across the country. He becomes an instant celebrity. You describe the White House ceremony where Dwight Eisenhower chokes back tears as he tells Salk, I have no words to thank you. I am very, very happy. And at the same time, he's losing favor with the scientific community. Why was that?
Well, he was a young researcher at the time. He wasn't a member of what I call the scientific brotherhood. And his research was funded through the March of Dimes, as were most of the other polio vaccine people at that time. And they all belonged to a group, and they were kind of lockstep going along, planning to develop a vaccine. And he went ahead and developed one really in secret and tested it in secret. But he challenged one of their most firmly held principles, and that is that most senior virologists believe that only a vaccine made of a live virus could impart lifelong immunity, as had been the case in smallpox, and he made a vaccine from a killed virus. Others, on April 12, once the announcement was made by Thomas Francis and Jonas Salk got up then and gave a talk, he was the hero of the day, and many of the scientists said that he had grabbed the limelight and neglected to mention those who had laid the groundwork for his vaccine. And although he did try to share the credit, the news people made Salk personify the events kind of surrounding the polio story and made him into this international icon. Another is that he reached out into the public way scientists had never done. He returned personally, answered every letter that the public sent to him, because they had given the dimes to support his research. And with his success, there was this wave of celebrity that had really been accorded few scientists in the history of medicine. Not that he didn't contribute a little to his own rejection.
Mm-hmm.
He had an unconventional approach to science. He had kind of a convoluted manner of writing. He loved metaphor in his writing. So he didn't behave like an academic scientist. He gave interviews to Parent magazine. That wasn't something that academic researchers did in that day. As he said, I marched to a different drummer, and he certainly did.
How did he get to this point? He was 40 when he created the vaccine. Tell us a little bit about his upbringing.
Well, he grew up in an immigrant family on the west side. He actually was born in East Harlem and then moved actually to the Bronx. and his mother had come from Russia during the pogroms. So he did grow up in a very tight Jewish family. His father was a lace maker, kind of in and out of work. But his mother told him, her firstborn, that he was born with a call, that meant he had special powers and he was destined for greatness. And he actually believed her, and he was a very spiritual child. And so he always, from the time he was a young child, was dreaming about doing something great to save the world. He was smart, but he wasn't brilliant, and he was small, and he was pretty much of an introvert. His teachers did realize he was pretty smart and recommended that the family have him apply to go to Townsend Harris High School, which he got into. From there, he went to City College, and at that point, he always thought he was going to be a lawyer, but he fell in love with the sciences, went to medical school at NYU, and during his medical school training, decided that he really wanted to be a researcher, which was pretty unusual at that time. Almost everyone in his class went on to practice medicine and started doing some research work with Thomas Francis, which led finally to the development of the first influenza vaccine. And he was really wanted to develop a universal vaccine, was a little bit at odds with Thomas Francis because he wanted to be so independent. And then in 1947, Harry Weaver, the research director for the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, asked him to participate in a project where they were trying to determine the different types of poliovirus. He initially accepted that, thinking he'd use those funds to really support his influenza research, but he just became passionate about polio and took off from there. He was a very independent, tenacious, incredibly hardworking man.
We've only covered sort of his life up to the vaccine, and of course there's a lot more, his marriage, very interestingly, to Picasso's former mistress, Françoise Gillot, and the founding of the Salk Institute. But what did you find the most interesting period of Salk's life? Where did you feel like you were learning something new?
The first big surprise to me, there are many, was that this kind of international idol whose smile shone from every newspaper and magazine when I was growing up didn't live happily ever after, not only because of the scientific community's rebuke of him, which was a major sadness for him, but the burden of being this world icon really was like an albatross around his neck. The Salk Institute, which I thought would likely be, to be honest, a fairly dry portion of the book, turned out to be fascinating with his relationship with Louis Kahn and his all the problems he faced at the Salk Institute, which he had set up in order to kind of find a refuge where scientists and humanists could work side by side. He said, imbue the sciences with the conscience of man. But he, in the end, ran into multiple problems and finally was pretty much deposed by those for whom he had built this Shangri-La. So that I found fascinating. I didn't know that he was such a solitary man throughout his life. At almost every corner, there was some new surprise about him. I didn't know that he was responsible for making probably the first successful influenza vaccine in his work with Thomas Francis.
Well, it's a fascinating life, a major new biography. Charlotte, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Charlotte DeCrows-Jacobs is the author of Jonas Salk, A Life, reviewed this week by David Oshinsky. John Williams joins us now. He's going to act on behalf of our listeners and readers who had some questions for us this week. Hi, John.
Hi, Pamela. How are you?
All right. I'm good. What are the questions?
Well, last week we prompted people to write in and ask us questions, address their questions to you and other editors at the Book Review. And we got a lot of response, some of which we'll save for a later date, but we're going to start with a couple of interesting questions we got. The first was over email from a reader named Andrea Minerchek, and she asked, do you wait until the review comes in before you decide whether or not to interview an author on air to avoid the potential embarrassment of discussing a poorly reviewed book with its creator?
Yes, we do. I am all for avoiding embarrassment of all kinds. But I think, you know, it would be uncomfortable for the author as well as for me. And in those cases, often we will talk to the critics. So this week, for example, you heard earlier on the show Jeff Schessel talking about H.W. Brands' biography of Ronald Reagan. The review itself was not overly favorable. And so my questions for Jeff were, in part, why not? And that's something I can't ask the author.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting to talk about a book critically, but not so much with its author. The other question came in via Twitter, which many of these questions did, from Donna Behen, who tweets as Madonna Patricia. And she asked, why are some books reviewed by the New York Times more than once? And this is a question that many people ask us.
Yes, this is not unfamiliar. There are two major areas where the books are reviewed in the Times, although they also appear in other sections, further confusing things. But the daily critics in the Daily Arts section of the paper are our three main critics, Michiko Kakutani, the chief critic, Janet Maslin, and Dwight Garner, and they pick which books they are going to review. At the Sunday Book Review, our editors decide which books we want to have reviewed, and then we generally go outside the paper, although we do also go within the paper, but not to, in generally, to people at the book review. And we find who we think would be the best, most interesting, most exciting person to review a given book. And the reviews themselves differ. The Daily Book Review is more of a traditional book review. It sort of tells you what's in the book, what's done well, what isn't done well, and puts it into the context of earlier work or similar work that's out there, especially if it's nonfiction. Although also in the case of fiction, if you review a new Philip Roth, not that there are going to be any more of those, you are going to talk about earlier Philip Roth books. At the book review, we often go longer and we tend to go a little bit deeper, more broader, some more context. We try to get people from critics from very different walks. So some of them are professional literary critics, but we also have novelists reviewing. We have academics reviewing, often nonfiction books, and, you know, sometimes some very unexpected reviewers. One recent example would be Carol Walker on the Toni Morrison novel. Carol Walker is primarily a visual artist, and this was the first book review that she had done. So we're offering a kind of another view. And the reason why there are sometimes duplicated books is because there are those books that the Daily Critics deem of interest and importance to New York Times readers that we editors at the book review also consider to be important. And, you know, from my perspective, as a reader, I personally find having more than one review really informative, because sometimes you disagree with a reviewer, or different critics will choose different things to focus on, and it just broadens that perspective. It helps you know what to read and not read, and to know enough about a book if you fall into the latter category.
Yeah, agreed. I think it's just great to have as many voices as possible writing about books and covering books in this cultural climate.
And that was the 2-minute answer, but I could actually go on for 10 more minutes. So if you have any more questions following up on that question, or other questions for us at the Book Review, any of us here, we are happy to answer them on air. You can email us at books@nytimes.com or tweet to us at the New York Times Book Review.
At NY Times Books.
There you go, the official Twitter handle. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Pamela.
Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list?
Well, on the fiction side of things, there's a new book down at number 16 called The Water Knife by a guy named Paolo Bacigalupi. See how I did on that pronunciation.
One of them will be right.
Yeah. It's kind of a futuristic science fiction thriller based on a world that's just been wiped out by drought. So another look at kind of climate change and post-apocalyptic dystopian future that's in store for us thanks to climate change.
Everything either drowns or dries up.
Exactly.
All right.
Then at number nine, the final novel by Kent Harif, Our Souls at Night, which still looks at the Colorado town where all of his previous books have been set. Then at number eight.
Another a challenge for the pronunciation police
this is
here.
Not a good. I should have practiced beforehand. At number eight, I do think it's Chuck Palahniuk, the author, of course, of Fight Club and many other books since then, has his very first story collection called Make Something Up. That's new at number eight. Finally, some easy names to pronounce at number four. Clive Cussler, with his co-writer Boyd Morrison, has a novel called Piranha. And then at number one, Nelson DeMille returns to the list with Radiant Angel, which is the seventh book in his John Quarry series.
And what's new in nonfiction?
A couple of new titles on the nonfiction list. Down at number 14, the neurosurgeon Henry Marsh, who was at the center of that documentary, The English Surgeon, has a book called Do No Harm, new at number 14. And at number six, Nick Offerman, the comic actor best known for his role on Parks and Recreation, has his second bestseller. This one's called Gumption, new at number six, and it's a look at 21 Americans who have inspired him.
Well, if people buy each other 4th of July presents, I guess they can choose this. All right. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.